59-year-old Ray Grecar had been the district attorney of Centre County, Pennsylvania for nearly 20 years. After all those years, two divorces, and the tragic death of his older brother, Ray was ready to take a step back. A year before his disappearance, Ray announced that he would not seek re-election and would be retiring at the end of his term. On April 15, 2005, Ray told his girlfriend Patty that he was going to take the day off. He wanted to enjoy the warming weather and go for a drive, which was one of his favorite things to do. Later that morning, Ray called Patty to explain he was driving down State Route 192 and heading east. This would be the last confirmed contact with Ray Grecar. When Ray failed to return home, Patty contacted police, who sprung into action, searching far and wide for the missing DA. When his car was found the next day, it provided more questions than answers. Later investigation revealed that Ray's county-issued laptop was missing, and he'd been searching the internet for knowledge on how to erase and destroy a hard drive. Months later, his laptop was discovered in the Susquehanna River, missing its hard drive, which would be found several months after that. Questions abound about Ray's disappearance. Could he have made the same terrible mistake as his brother and committed suicide? Did he simply choose to walk away, disappearing into a quiet life of anonymity? Or could Ray have been the victim of foul play, perhaps at the hands of someone who he'd previously sent to prison? And of course, what exactly was on Ray's hard drive that he wanted to get rid of? And does the answer to this mystery lie somewhere in that drive? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 72, The Disappearance of Ray Grecar. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today's episode focuses on the highly requested disappearance of Ray Grecar in 2005. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances, examining a different case each Monday. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at @TraceEvPod, on Instagram at @TraceEvidencePod, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and much more. Trace Evidence is also on Patreon, so if you would like to support the show, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can get rewards such as stickers, pins, and commercial-free episodes. There's also a PayPal donation link on the website for those of you who don't wish to go through Patreon. This show is a complete one-man operation, and your support is greatly appreciated. On today's episode, we examine the inexplicable disappearance of Ray Grecar from Centre County, Pennsylvania, in April of 2005. This is a case filled with twists and turns, a great deal of questions, and very few answers. This is Episode 72, The Disappearance of Ray Grecar. Ray Frank Grecar was born on October 9, 1945 in Cleveland, Ohio. Ray was the second child of the family, with his older brother Roy having come along a few years prior. Ray's family lived in the predominantly Polish section of the Collinwood neighborhood, located on the east side of Cleveland. Collinwood, known as a quiet place and a good location to raise a family, entered the public scene in the 1970s when a war broke out between different organized crime groups, which resulted in the arrival of federal investigators and multiple convictions, which essentially broke the back of the mafia in the area. Ray was, by all accounts, a quiet, private, respectful, and studious young man. He would go on to attend school at the Gilmore Academy, a Roman Catholic campus which operated both a day school as well as a boarding school. The Gilmore Academy was located in Gates Mills, Ohio, just 20 miles or so away from his neighborhood. Ray's attendance at the academy was marked by high grades and a strong determination to succeed. If there is a word which seems to pop up consistently in Ray's life, it's drive. Ray had a laser-like focus, sharp and determined, and when he set his sights on something, he was unlikely to waver. This was an attribute acquired at a young age, which would only become stronger throughout his life. In addition to this, many have described Ray as fiercely independent. He went his own way, regardless of the odds. He didn't back down from the path he wanted to walk. Ray's upbringing in Cleveland had a strong impact on his life, particularly in terms of his interests. He would develop a lifelong love of the Cleveland Indians baseball team, as well as the Browns football team. Aside from being an avid sports fan, Ray had a charming personality, and his intelligence was quickly ascertained as soon as he was engaged in conversation. Behind those intense eyes, the gears were always turning in his mind. Though, Ray knew how to kick back as well, and he took great joy in long drives. There was something in the freedom of sailing down the road that just helped ease his stress and clear his mind. Ray's career in law sort of occurred by chance. Ray obtained an internship which forever altered the course of his life. He found himself working for the prosecutor's office, and as he entered college at the University of Dayton, it was law in which he found his interest most strongly piqued. It would appear that from this time in Ray's life, that determined focus wasn't going to shift. Law would not be the only significant change to occur while attending school at Dayton. It was during this time that Ray would meet and fall in love with Barbara Gray. After graduation, Ray returned to Cleveland with Barbara by his side, where he would enter the Case Western Reserve University School of Law. Ray and Barbara would marry in 1969, and once Ray earned his law degree, he would take a job working as a prosecutor for Cuyahoga County. Some 9 years after being married, Ray and Barbara would adopt a baby girl, Laura, in 1978. In 1980, everything would change. Barbara was offered a job at Pennsylvania State University, and so the family packed up and moved. It was during this time that Ray made the decision to take a step back from his career. In order to support Barbara and to give himself more time with his daughter, Ray made the decision to become a stay-at-home father. This decision, though, was short-lived, as Ray was rather quickly offered an assistant district attorney position for Center County, Pennsylvania's DA, David E. Grine. Soon, Ray found himself turning heads in the DA's office, and when Grine's successor, Robert Mix, made the decision not to run for re-election 5 years later, in 1985, Ray decided to throw his name into the hat. When the election was over, Ray Grecar had become the district attorney of Center County, Pennsylvania, by a margin of just 600 votes. When Ray took over as district attorney, it was only a part-time position, and this allowed him to focus both on his career and his family. Regardless of career paths and available time, though, the marriage between Ray and Barbara had begun to fall apart, and the couple officially divorced in 1991. Despite their differences, the former couple were able to raise Laura together. 5 years later, 1996 would be a year of tremendous highs and incredible lows. After being re-elected as district attorney in both 1989 and 1993, Ray began campaigning to make the position full-time and was successful. Now, operating as a full-time district attorney, Ray gave even more focus to the cases he was overseeing. However, his personal life would also see changes as he would marry his second wife, Emma, that same year. While things seemed to be going exceedingly well for Ray, a tragic event would occur that would mirror Ray's future in a disturbing and heartbreaking manner. In May of 96, Ray's older brother Roy went missing from Westchester, Ohio. Days later, Roy's vehicle was found abandoned in a park. Several days after that, Roy's body was recovered from the Great Miami River. Investigators ultimately ruled Roy's death to be a case of suicide. Roy had battled depression for a long time, and it appeared that he had tragically lost that battle. Roy and Ray had been close, and following his brother's death, Ray became even closer with his two nephews, being there for them and trying to help them through this difficult and dark time. Of course, There were those who felt Ray was never satisfied with the official ruling. Bob Buhner later recalled, quote, "Ray never believed his brother committed suicide. The most important reason was that he thought his brother would never orphan his two sons." End quote. At the time, no one could possibly have imagined that less than 10 years later, Ray himself would vanish under eerily similar circumstances. Ray would go on to be elected to his position once again the following year, in 1997, and a year after that, he would be heavily involved in the initial probe into allegations of sexual assault against longtime Penn State football assistant coach Jerry Sandusky, who operated under head coach Joe Paterno. Outside of Penn State, Sandusky was highly involved in the Second Mile, an organization designed to assist troubled teenagers. At the time, two 11-year-old boys came forward with accusations, alleging that Sandusky had entered the shower with them and inappropriately touched and, quote-unquote, washed them, though this was a polite euphemism for Sandusky having actually molested the boys. As the district attorney overseeing this accusation, Ray was the one who had the final say on how to proceed. According to investigators at the time, Grecar took the allegations seriously and even went so far as to hide a police officer inside the home of one of the children's mothers as she confronted Sandusky in hopes of getting a confession. When all was said and done, though, for reasons perhaps no one truly knows, Ray made the choice not to pursue prosecution. Sandusky retired in 1999, where he was awarded the title of Professor Emeritus and given an office on campus from which he would continue his egregious acts. In retrospect, many of those who had been involved at the time would later come forward when new allegations were raised. When asked why they hadn't pursued prosecution the first time, it was explained that that choice had been Ray's and he had elected not to. When asked about this later, Bob Buhner, then District Attorney of Montour County, responded, quote, "He would be extremely cautious in proceeding because he wanted to make sure that there would be a reasonable likelihood of conviction. You don't want to go after someone high profile unless you have a compelling case." End quote. Some would later speculate that it was Sandusky's high profile and beloved status at Penn State that impacted Ray's decision, but those who knew him emphatically disagreed. Steve Sloan, an assistant prosecutor and one of Ray's closest friends, explained, quote, "He didn't read local papers and follow local gossip. It wouldn't have mattered if it was Joe Paterno or a 10-repeat felon. He would treat them the same way if they were legit suspected of committing crimes." End quote. Ray was well respected in his position as district attorney, and for many, they believed that if he didn't prosecute the case, he had a reason. What that was, we may never fully know. He had been involved in several high-profile cases, including the prosecution of 19-year-old Jillian Robbins in 1996, when she strode onto the campus of Penn State University and opened fire with a rifle, killing one student and wounding another. It's interesting to note that many who step into public service roles have higher political aspirations, which can play a role in their decisions as they might be trying to garner future support. But this didn't apply to Ray. He didn't want to get involved in politics, and his dreams of the future were of a quiet retirement. For many, this made Ray impervious to political persuasion, as he had absolutely no interest in establishing a career as a politician. Ray would continue working as the full-time district attorney, and as seems to be the case with his life, 2001 was yet another year which would bring in the good and the bad. Re-elected yet again, Ray's career was surging, but his personal life was falling apart. 2001 would also see the dissolution of his second marriage, with he and Emma separating. Many have since described the marriage between Ray and Emma as doomed nearly from the start, and marred by disagreements. A single man, it wouldn't be long before a romantic interest would develop, and in this instance, it would happen in a place where he'd least expected it, at the office. Patty Fornicola worked at the courthouse, and as the relationship developed, the couple decided to move in together. Ray would move into Patty's home, located in the Bellefonte, Pennsylvania neighborhood of Half Moon Hill. While it was clear that Ray and Patty were very much in love, both had seen previous marriages end poorly, and so there was no rush to tie the knot. When asked about Ray, Patty explained, quote, "We had a wonderful relationship. I think for both of us, we finally found our soulmate. We found the person who was perfect. He really enjoyed just quiet times and just being together." End quote. The relationship was going well, and by all accounts, Ray and Patty were very happy together. Several years into their time together, in 2004, Ray began delegating more of his responsibilities to assistant district attorneys. He cut back on his workload, started spending a little more time away from the job. Eventually, Ray confided in Patty his interest in retiring after that term. Ray was ready to enjoy life, to take it easy, travel, do all of the things he'd always wanted to do. Ray told his daughter, Laura, of his plans. She was living in Washington State at the time, and Ray and Patty discussed a plan to drive to visit her, stopping at national parks and landmarks along the way. Then, Ray informed his staff and publicly announced that he would not seek re-election. Ray's final term as district attorney was set to end on January 1st, 2006. Sadly, Ray wouldn't make it to retirement, and less than 1 year before he was ready to step out of his position, he would vanish under what can only be described as baffling circumstances in April of 2005. The morning of Friday, April 15th, began as many others had, with Patty Fornicola up first, getting ready for her day of work. As she began putting her day in order, Ray was in the bedroom, sleeping still. Patty entered the room to notify Ray that it was time to get up and get ready for work, but on this occasion, Ray had other plans. According to Patty, Ray explained that he didn't think he'd be going into work that day. As Ray often called it, he was going to play hooky and just take the day off. To Patty, this wasn't hugely out of the ordinary, and Ray had worked incredibly hard. He deserved a day to himself here and there. The 59-year-old DA had been working the job for nearly 20 years. Who could blame him for needing a day here and there? Patty told Ray to have a nice day and that she loved him. She went into the kitchen, poured a glass of orange juice for Ray, and left behind a note asking if he'd be able to take care of the dog since he'd be home. Patty left for the courthouse, never knowing that this would be the last time she'd ever see Ray. While Patty was at work later that morning, she was filling in at the receptionist desk for an employee who was out for the day. At approximately 11:30 a.m., the phone rang, and when Patty answered, she found Ray on the other end. According to Patty, Ray seemed somewhat caught off guard that she'd answered the phone, but he had apparently called to speak with her. Ray explained that he was going for a drive in his red Mini Cooper, taking Route 192 in an east-northeast direction towards Lewisburg, an area he'd been to many times before. Route 192 runs from Center Hall to Lewisburg, covering a total of 45.4 miles, winding through the countryside. This was fitting for Ray's normal behavior, as he often took drives to clear his head or simply relax. On this particular day, the weather was warming up a bit, and he wanted to enjoy it. Ray told Patty that, because of his trip, he wouldn't be able to take care of the dog. According to Patty, the call ended with them exchanging I love yous. This is the last confirmed contact anyone has with Ray Grecar. For Patty, the rest of the day continued as normal. She assumed that when she got home from work, she'd find Ray at the house and they'd discuss their days. Arriving home around 5:10 p.m., Patty was a little surprised that Ray wasn't there. At the same time, she considered the possibilities. Ray may have gone to see a movie, or stopped at a local bar to grab a beer and watch a game. Not thinking too much about it, Patty went down to the local YMCA to use the gym. She completed her workout and arrived home at approximately 7 p.m. Ray still wasn't there, and this time, Patty began to think that it was out of the ordinary. Wondering what could be going on, Patty made a series of calls to Ray's cell phone, but each one went straight to voicemail. Still not completely worried, Patty figured Ray would be back soon. However, when another hour passed, Patty could no longer suppress her concerns. Starting around 8 p.m., Patty began frantically calling Ray's cell phone. Each call, again, went straight to voicemail. She considered the possibilities that, having driven through the country, Ray may be in an area where he had no service, or maybe the battery in his phone died. That didn't change her plans, though, and she continued calling Ray every 10 to 15 minutes. She will continue making these calls for the next 3 hours, and when 11 p.m. arrives and she has still failed to receive an answer, and Ray hasn't come home, she starts to believe that something must be wrong. Between 11 and 11:30 p.m., Patty places a call to the Bellefonte Police Department to report Ray as missing, as no one has seen or had contact with him for 12 hours. Being that Ray is a public figure and works as part of law enforcement, the response was quick and focused. The Bellefonte Police Chief, Dwayne Dixon, got involved, and first thought was that Ray may have experienced car trouble or perhaps gotten into an accident. Route 192 has curvy roads and is notorious for accidents involving deer. Patrol units were issued to drive that road, tracing Ray's path in hopes of seeing some indication of where he may have gone. While 192 was being swept, other units were sent all over town, looking for any sign of Ray or his red Mini Cooper. In the immediate aftermath of the 911 call, no one thought anything dramatic had occurred. Certainly the idea of a crime hadn't crossed anyone's mind, but when police failed to find any trace of Ray or his vehicle, concern began to grow. At the same time, this wasn't entirely unlike Ray. While normally he would tell Patty or someone where he was going, and at a minimum he'd have called, he had gone off before without letting anyone know. One particular incident took place during his previous marriage. After an argument, Ray had driven out of state, back to Ohio, where he'd gone to a Cleveland Indians baseball game. When authorities were informed of this detail, they placed a call to Jacobs Field, now Progressive Field, and requested that security do a sweep of the parking lot looking for Ray's car, but again, nothing was found. When all searching resulted in nothing, police issued an all-points bulletin to be on the lookout for Ray and his red Mini Cooper. This bulletin began with a 60-mile radius, but will eventually expand to statewide and then nationwide. Authorities also notified 6 police departments in surrounding states. By Saturday, April 16th, there had still been no contact and Ray hadn't been located. Patty decided it was time to call Lara and explain to her that her father was missing. It was a call Patty dreaded, and for both women, it became a bad dream from which they could not awaken. Lara began making arrangements to fly out to Pennsylvania to assist in searches and to find out exactly what was going on. At this time, authorities spoke with Patty again in hopes of gaining more information. When discussing the 11:30 a.m. phone call from the previous day, they decided to ping Ray's cell phone. This resulted in confirmation of his whereabouts at the time of the call, showing him progressing down Route 192. However, due to his phone being either powered off or damaged, they couldn't ping its current location. Authorities at this time sent an airplane to fly over Center Hall, Route 192, and Lewisburg, though no sign of Ray's vehicle was noted. Patty will later be extensively questioned by both police and assistant district attorneys, cooperating fully. She later volunteers to take a polygraph test, which she passes. Details brought up by Patty during her questioning did raise some concerns at the time. In regard to his recent behavior, Patty explained that Ray had been sleeping a lot. He'd been cutting back on his work and seemed to be tired. Patty recalled actually questioning Ray about this, noting that his naps were growing longer and more frequent, but Ray was dismissive of it. For authorities, knowing that Ray's brother had suffered from depression and committed suicide, they began to wonder if it was possible that Ray himself was experiencing similar issues. Ray's friends and family, though, find it highly unlikely that he would have gone and committed suicide. Not only did he not believe his brother had done so, but he was planning for the future and didn't appear to be in a troubled state of mind. At 5 p.m. on the 16th, Police Chief Dwayne Dixon called in the media for a press conference. At the time, the press conference wasn't so much to discuss a particular theory, but more so to drum up attention. Dixon provided photos of both Ray and his car noting that his last known location was heading east on Route 192. Anyone with information or who saw the Mini Cooper was asked to contact authorities. Just 90 minutes after the press conference began, at 6:30 p.m., Bellefonte police received a call from the state police. An officer driving through Lewisburg happened to spot a vehicle which resembled Ray's, sitting in a parking lot across from the street of shops, an antiques mall which Ray had been known to visit in the past, some 55 miles from home. Upon pulling into the parking lot, the officer ran the license plate and was able to confirm that it was in fact the vehicle of Ray Grecar. When investigators arrived at Ray's car, some 36 hours after he disappeared, they hoped it would provide them with answers. Unfortunately, it would actually raise more questions. The first thing noted about the Mini Cooper was that it was parked normally, seemed to be in fine order, and there was nothing directly indicating any crime or issues had taken place near it. Once inside, they found that the vehicle was neat, though they did detect the scent of cigarette smoke, which was curious since Ray was not a smoker and he didn't like the smell of cigarettes. Ray's county-issued cell phone was located inside the vehicle and was in good working order, though it had been powered off. For the most part, investigators weren't able to glean very much from the car, but there was one detail which stood out. As has been established, Ray was not a smoker, and yet in addition to the smell in the car, there was also some ash on the floor of the front passenger side, suggesting that someone had either been smoking in the vehicle or perhaps talking to Ray through the passenger side window while smoking. This was supported by the fact that multiple cigarette butts were found outside the vehicle on the passenger side. These butts were bagged for processing. Unfortunately, there was little to be done with the ashes, as Detective Matt Rickard explained, quote, "A cigarette ash has no forensic value whatsoever. You wouldn't be able to test it for anything," end quote. After an initial look through the vehicle, it was then transported from the parking lot to a local state police station where it would be processed for forensic evidence. Inside the vehicle, multiple fingerprints were found, but they were not detailed enough to attempt an identification. Additional fingerprints were found on the outside of the driver's side window, and these were quite detailed and later identified as belonging to Ray. There were also fingerprints found on Ray's cell phone, but they were too smudged to properly identify either. The cigarette butts, on the other hand, did provide some evidence. DNA was able to be extracted from the filters of the cigarettes, though when law enforcement ran it through the system, it came back with no matches, meaning that whoever had been smoking those cigarettes had not been arrested since the implementation of DNA, nor did they hold a state or federal position. That DNA remains unmatched some 14 years later. For Ray's family, the circumstances of his vehicle's discovery brought back bad memories. When Ray's brother Roy had gone missing, his vehicle had been located not far from a bridge and a river. His body was later recovered from the Great Miami River. In a startling coincidence, Ray's red Mini Cooper was located not far from two bridges spanning the Susquehanna River, one of which was the PA 45 bridge, running between Lewisburg and Milton. Considering Roy's fate, Ray's excessive sleeping in the weeks leading up to his disappearance, and the fact that depression can run in families, investigators subpoenaed Ray's medical records. Ray, though, wasn't a huge proponent of medications, nor of seeking medical assistance. His records came back with no indication of depression or any other health issues, and close friends and family made note that Ray wouldn't even take an aspirin if he had a headache, let alone anything else. This could suggest that if indeed Ray was suffering from depression, he would not have sought treatment. On Sunday, April 17th, a massive search was organized to take place both in and along the banks of the Susquehanna River. State police supplied a helicopter, which was flown all around the river, the shore, and the surrounding areas. Cadaver dogs were brought in, including one which was brought on board a boat to traverse up and down the river, though the dogs all failed to detect any scent. A tracking dog was brought to the parking lot where Ray's car had been found, and while the dog clearly indicated Ray's scent in the parking lot, it did not detect anything outside of that space, suggesting that Ray may have left the area in another vehicle. Divers were also brought in to search the river, though the search itself was hindered by several issues. Being that it was April, the waters were still quite cold and difficult for searchers to be in for too long. Beyond that, as the temperatures in the surrounding area warmed up, winter runoff poured into the river. The waters surged to heights greater than normal. In addition to that, family noted that Ray was not a strong swimmer, and considering the rushing current of the river at this time of year, even if he'd fallen in accidentally, he'd have been unlikely to have gotten out on his own. The search was quite extensive, but after 24 hours it was called off. There was some debate at the time about whether or not they'd have been likely to locate Ray's remains had he been in the river. Detective Rickard explained, quote, "Most cases, the body surfaces, but there has been instances where somebody has gone into the river and never been located," end quote. I've read multiple reports about bodies being recovered from the Susquehanna, including those of two men pulled out in March of 2016 and another man in August of 2018, though this doesn't mean that bodies are easily recovered there. It should be noted that multiple dams are found along the Susquehanna. Detective Daryl Zakagni noted that had Ray's remains been pushed by currents to a dam, there's a good chance it could have been excessively damaged, leaving little to recover. After the discovery of the car and the river search, authorities kicked their investigation into high gear. Ray had been missing for more than 48 hours, and the harder they dug, the more questions they faced. On Monday, April 18th, another press conference was held, this time including both Patty and Lara, who made public appeals. Lara made an emotional statement saying, quote, "I want more than anything to hear your voice and for you to hug me. Maybe we can go for a hike. Go hike up a mountain and sit and talk. Please call. To everyone else out there, if you've seen my father, please contact the police," end quote. Numerous witnesses came forward with sightings of Ray, though they were all either before or on the day he disappeared. A co-worker at the courthouse noted seeing Ray driving his Mini Cooper and turning onto Route 192 sometime between 11 a.m. and 12 p.m. Two other witnesses reported seeing Ray near the Packwood House Museum in Lewisburg, not far from the parking lot where his car would eventually be found. According to the witnesses, Ray sat in the Mini Cooper, parked across the street from the museum. One particular witness alleged to have seen Ray exiting the vehicle and walking, though he later returned and once again sat in the car. The witness felt like Ray was waiting for someone, though this can't be confirmed. Another witness reported seeing Ray at approximately 5:30 p.m., parking his car in the space where it was eventually found. This sighting, along with the tracking dog's indication, leads investigators to believe that it was indeed Ray who parked the car in that space and not someone else who may have been driving it. In hopes of figuring out what may have been going on, investigators began looking into Ray's life in the days leading up to his disappearance. The day before, courthouse security cameras captured Ray parking and entering the building at 6:19 p.m. He then left at 8:07 p.m. Nothing appeared to be out of the ordinary, and no one seemed to be following him. Ray's work computer was then subjected to a forensic examination, at which time several confusing details were discovered. Firstly, Ray, or someone accessing his work computer, had visited the website MapQuest, seeking directions to Lewisburg. This made little sense since Ray had been to Lewisburg multiple times and certainly wouldn't have needed directions. They were also informed by co-workers at the time that in the previous few weeks, Ray had been asking questions about how to wipe a hard drive clean. After examination of his work computer, authorities then proceeded on to the home he shared with Patty. Investigators looked through the home, though they were unable to locate anything which would suggest to them that a crime had taken place at that location. Patty led them to the home computer, which was taken and analyzed. Ray's home computer showed previous Google searches for how to fry a hard drive and how to destroy and erase a hard drive and water damage to laptops. Patty informed investigators that Ray had recently purchased software designed to erase computer hard drives, but that this was not out of the ordinary. He was going to be leaving his position with the county, and he wanted to ensure he didn't leave behind any personal information. According to Patty, Ray had purchased the software which he kept in the case with his county-issued laptop. When investigators requested the laptop, Patty produced the case, but to her surprise, neither the laptop nor the erasing software were inside. The power supply had been left behind, but the laptop was gone. This was out of the ordinary, as Ray typically left the laptop at home. For authorities, it became a question of why Ray would have taken the laptop with him the day he vanished. Nothing else of Ray's was noted as missing from the home, outside of a pair of sunglasses. All of his clothing, luggage, and personal belongings were left behind. His wallet and keys were also believed to be with him. New searches were conducted in the areas around where Ray's car had been found and the river in hopes of locating his laptop, but again, nothing was discovered. In an attempt to get a better picture of Ray's life at the time of his disappearance, the Bellefonte police contacted the FBI for their assistance. The FBI was requested to conduct a forensic analysis of Ray's financial records. Unfortunately, this examination yielded little information. As a district attorney, Ray earned $129,000 a year. He had a savings account totaling $100,000 and had no major investments. There was no record or indication of large changes in his finances, no large sums of money in or out. There is, of course, the question of where a lot of his money went. If he were earning over $100,000 a year, why did he only have $100,000 in his savings account? Records indicate that Ray had purchased the Mini Cooper with cash and had also paid off the mortgage on Patty's home. Beyond that, there was nothing in the analysis to suggest any type of criminal or under-the-table activity. Despite their efforts, authorities began to acknowledge that the case was growing cold and their leads, what few they had, were trailing off. Over the course of the next few months, police continued their investigation but were unable to come up with much. They found more witnesses who reported seeing Ray, some of whom claimed to have seen him in the Lewisburg area on the 16th, the day after he was reported missing, though these sightings have never been confirmed. There wouldn't be a break in the case until July 30th, some 107 days after Ray had last been seen. A fisherman sailing along the Susquehanna River, which by this time had sunk down low and was flowing slowly, spotted an object beneath the water. Reaching in, the fisherman produced a laptop. Knowing Ray's story, authorities were contacted and it was confirmed to be Ray's laptop. Its exact location of discovery was consistent with the possibility that the laptop had been tossed or dropped from the PA 45 bridge. For investigators, this was great news, as they hoped to discover information on the laptop which might give them a lead, but to their shock, the hard drive had been removed from the laptop. According to Detective Rickard, quote, "In this particular model of computer, it's fairly difficult to remove the hard drive, and if the laptop were thrown into the river, the hard drive wouldn't have just tumbled out. So it was hopeful, it was uplifting, but then again, it was kind of a disappointment because we really needed to find that hard drive." End quote. The discovery of the laptop and the absence of the hard drive pushed investigators more towards a theory that foul play may have resulted in Ray's disappearance. With the laptop discovered, but no hard drive to work with, the case once again began to grow cold. The next update would come just over 2 months later, on October 1st. Two children, playing along the banks of the Susquehanna River, made an interesting discovery. Lying there, waterlogged and rusted, was a laptop hard drive, approximately 100 yards upstream from the location of where the laptop had been found. This discovery reinvigorated investigators who came in possession of the drive, but quickly realized they did not possess the technology to unlock its secrets. First, the hard drive was sent to California, where it was processed by the Secret Service, though they were unable to retrieve any data due to the damage the drive had sustained. This was followed up by the FBI, who also came up blank when trying to pull data from the drive. Sources indicated that not only had the drive been damaged by water, but internal hardware was broken, making the process even more difficult. In a desperate attempt to retrieve the information, the hard drive was sent to Minnesota, where it was processed by Crawl On Track, a renowned company known for both erasing and restoring digital data. Crawl On Track had previously gained notoriety when they were able to recover 99% of the data from the drives retrieved from the wreckage of the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster. By the time the hard drive was in Crawl's hands, additional damage had been done to it by other organizations trying to retrieve the data. Crawl fixed or replaced multiple pieces of hardware and cleaned away as much of the corrosion as possible, but in the end, they were unable to retrieve the data, if indeed any data existed. Due to the state of the drive, Crawl was unable to determine if the drive erasing software had been run. Yet another piece of evidence that carried so much promise failed to deliver any insight. For investigators, this was another frustrating blow and raised the question, if this could possibly have been a suicide, why destroy the laptop and hard drive? What information it revealed would mean little to a dead man. Over 7 months would pass, totaling some 13 months since Ray disappeared, before investigators revealed a detail they had previously been concealing. Multiple witnesses at the Antiques Mall the day Ray vanished reported seeing him, but he wasn't alone. According to witnesses, Ray was observed in the company of a woman who has been described as standing between 5 feet 8 and 5 feet 10 inches tall, with short, dark hair and a slim figure. Her age was estimated to have been mid-30s to 40s. According to investigators, this detail had been kept a secret as part of normal procedure, and due to the fact that they had a suspicion that they knew who the woman was. It wasn't until after they discovered that it was not who they suspected that it became important to release this information. According to the witnesses, there didn't appear to be a romantic relationship between Ray and the unknown woman. There was no touching or hand-holding. The two would enter stores together, split apart, and go into stores alone, and then meet again. This woman has never been identified, and her reasoning behind meeting Ray that day has never been discovered. But many assume if she didn't have something to hide, she'd have come forward by now, unless she too is missing. At the time of this revelation about the unidentified woman, it both reinvigorated the case and spun up the rumor mill. Suddenly, Ray was being written about as a ladies' man who was known to be flirty, and the possibility of an affair made the rounds in the media. This was exceedingly painful for Patty, who was already struggling to come to terms with his disappearance. For the most part, friends and family considered it highly unlikely that Ray was having an affair, and if he was, he likely wouldn't have gone to such measures to be secret about it. He wasn't married, he seemed happy with Patty, and even if he wasn't, he could have left the relationship anytime he wanted without needing to stray. Then again, the details of an affair don't always make a great deal of sense. Regardless, without information on the woman, there was little investigators could do to follow up, and by the time this information had been released to the public, the case was over a year old. Over the next few years, mentions of Ray in the media tended to either comment on the mystery surrounding his disappearance or the lack of developments in the case. Friends and colleagues of Ray's issued statements to the press questioning the skill or devotion of the investigators working the case, feeling that more should have been discovered. Investigators responded that they were doing everything that they could, which, at the time, consisted mostly of fielding tips and tracking down possible leads. Hundreds of sightings of Ray had been called in over the years, though investigators had never found anything solid. One woman in Texas had been so sure she'd seen Ray that she'd snapped pictures of him with her cell phone, but an FBI analysis determined it was not Ray. Sightings spanned the country, from the beaches of California to the streets of Manhattan to Eastern Europe. Monitoring of Ray's phone and bank record showed no activity since he disappeared. It was clear to most that the case was stalled. 5 years after Ray's disappearance, in 2010, newly elected District Attorney Stacy Parks Miller announced the creation of a task force to focus on Ray's case. The task force was made up of multiple individuals in law enforcement and other supporting fields, who were focused on digging into Ray's life, all records, and case files. They were determined to re-examine every piece of evidence, even tips which had been previously dismissed, in hopes of finding something new or making a connection. Parks Miller felt that the members of the team were hardworking and detail-oriented, just the type of investigators you'd want trying to figure out the details of a now 5-year-old cold case. The task force hit the same walls previous investigators had and were unable to reveal new leads. In fact, in the years since Ray vanished, multiple law enforcement units, including local police, state police, and the FBI, had all worked on the case in some form or fashion. Even a psychic was utilized for a period of time. For the record, the psychic first said she saw Ray entering the courthouse through the front door, which didn't seem likely considering he had an assigned spot near the back door. She did, however, tell authorities she saw a construction worker leaning into Ray's car while smoking a cigarette. They found that interesting, since details regarding the car hadn't been fully released at that time. The following year, in 2011, Lara, acting as the trustee of Ray's estate, petitioned the county court to have him declared legally dead. On July 25, 2011, Ray was declared dead in absentia, and all his estate was awarded in full to Lara. In a bizarre twist, just the next day, Utah police arrested a man who closely resembled Grekar and who refused to give his true identity. While this stirred up hope for the moment, fingerprints would later show that the man was not in fact Ray. The individual was later identified as Philip Todd Beavers, a Utah local who bore a striking resemblance to Ray. 2011 was also the year in which Jerry Sandusky was indicted on 40 counts of sex crimes against young boys as the result of a 2-year investigation launched by the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office. 8 additional charges would be added, and the following year, in 2012, Sandusky would be found guilty of 45 of the 48 charges against him. The prosecution of Sandusky raised questions about Ray's previous choice not to pursue charges, and whether or not his disappearance could be connected. Some believe Ray may have ended his own life due to guilt over his knowledge of but failure to prosecute Sandusky's crimes. Others wondered if Ray had been involved in a cover-up, and perhaps this was the information he had been looking to erase, while others still believe Ray may have been eliminated due to plans to expose a cover-up. For law enforcement, however, they find no connections between the Sandusky case and Ray's disappearance. In 2013, rumors began to circulate about the possibility that Ray had been murdered in response to a case he'd prosecuted years earlier. A man, alleging to have formerly been a member of the Hell's Angels biker gang, came forward with information indicating that another member of the gang had committed the crime. According to this individual, Ray had been murdered in revenge for prosecuting a member of the gang, and his body had been deposited in an abandoned mine shaft. While this lead was investigated and corroborated by a tip from a prison inmate who told a similar story, nothing was found. There was also the rumor that Ray had been murdered and buried in a grave in Blair County, but after extensive searching and the use of ground-penetrating radar, nothing was found there either. The following year, in 2014, the state police took over the case. They have had few comments to make since, other than to specify that Ray's case is still open and considered a missing persons case. In the years that have passed, rumors and speculation abound. Fingers have pointed in all directions, from a former prisoner to a member of law enforcement to the CIA. Some have suggested that Ray's alleged obsession with a missing law enforcement officer in Ohio may have played a role, while others believe a novel about time travel may have some involvement, considering Ray was a consultant on the book, and the story takes place on April 15th in several different years, the same day that Ray vanished. The story, in part, tells the tale of a fake death. Pre-planned disappearance, conspiracy, or merely another coincidence in a long line of them. In a case such as this, dealing with a high-profile individual operating in a publicly elected law enforcement position, There are a great many opinions on what may have happened, but all boil down to three essential theories. The first theory suggests that Ray's disappearance may in fact have been a suicide, much like his brother's. Supporters of this theory note Ray's withdrawn behavior at work, his increased sleepiness, and the circumstances of his disappearance mirroring that of his brother's. The second theory takes the angle that while Ray's disappearance may have been by his own choice, it might not be suicide. There are a lot of supporters, including some law enforcement, who believe that Ray is still alive out there somewhere. As a law enforcement official, many argue he would have a pretty good idea of how to go about getting off the grid. The third and final theory is that Ray Grecar was the victim of foul play. Whether this was tied to a case he had prosecuted, something he was looking into, a vendetta, or even a random act of violence can't be known for sure. But considering the absence of Ray's body and the recovery of his computer and hard drive, many believe Ray was murdered and his body disposed of elsewhere. Ray Grecar is described as a Caucasian male with graying brown hair and green eyes, standing 6 feet tall and weighing approximately 172 pounds. Ray was 59 when he vanished and would be 73 today. When last seen, Ray was wearing a blue fleece jacket, blue jeans, and sneakers. He was last seen in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, in the area surrounding the Street of Shops. Investigators advise Ray may use alternate last names, possibly Gray or Lang. In less than 1 month, it will be 14 years since Ray Grecar has been seen. For all of this time, friends, family, and his girlfriend have all struggled to come to terms with the likelihood that Ray isn't coming home. Patty refuses, saying that until she has confirmation otherwise, she still believes Ray is out there somewhere, and she's highly hopeful that he'll come walking through the door someday. And while she'll have some choice words for him, she'll welcome him right back into her life. For Lara, it's even more difficult. Having watched her uncle vanished and later be discovered deceased, she now has lived through the loss of her father and the absence of answers. When asked about Ray's disappearance, Lara responded, quote, "It's very hard, not having closure and knowing that I might go to my grave, not knowing whatever happened to him. I guess I'm coming to terms with the fact that they might not ever solve this case." The disappearance of Ray Grecar is a highly discussed, heavily debated case. Most people have their theory, and there's little which can be done to change their minds. With all of the information available, you'd think there'd be so much to dig into, but in reality, the closer you look at the evidence, the less you actually know about this case. All of the details about Ray's life seem to amount to him being someone people thought was a good man. He worked hard, weighed his options carefully, and tried to do right by people. Of course, with everyone you examine, there are those who don't have anything positive to say, and Ray is no different. For as many people admired and appreciated him, there were those who had a grudge or a vendetta, specifically those he sent away to prison. In 20 years as district attorney, Ray was involved in the prosecutions of a lot of people. That leaves an extremely long list of potential suspects, though for the most part, law enforcement feels they've examined pretty much everyone. Ray was a public figure, and in a town of 6,000, he stood out. Most people knew him by appearance, and those who didn't were certainly aware of him by name. But Ray, the district attorney, was not the same man at home. He was exceedingly private, avoided being in the spotlight as much as he could, and kept many of his opinions close to the vest. What we do know, beyond the shadow of a doubt, is that he cared greatly for his family. He loved his daughter with all of his heart, and he loved Patty as well. This is part of what makes the story so utterly heartbreaking, and the first theory so difficult to accept. Is it possible that Ray Grecar committed suicide? Obviously, no theory can be completely ruled out when it comes to this case. This particular theory carries a certain weight to it which, while it may be difficult to examine, is important to look into. The most logical place to begin is with Ray's brother, Roy. Based on the information we have, Roy disappeared in 1996, was missing for several days, and then his body was recovered from the Great Miami River. We've been told by family members that Roy suffered from depression for a long time and battled it and ultimately lost that fight. But not everyone agrees, and according to several people, Ray certainly didn't believe that his brother took his own life. But we have to ask ourselves, was this a legitimate claim or the results of denial? Oftentimes, when someone takes their own life, close relatives and friends can't accept that ruling. It's an incredibly difficult thing to come to terms with the idea that someone you love, who seems happy, who you just talked to the other day, could take their own life. We've all read about the warning signs and the things to watch out for, but they can often be subtle and difficult to discern. Even in retrospect, one might struggle to believe the possibility. As someone who has lost someone to suicide, it certainly can weigh heavily on you. The guilt you can feel for not being there for them, or for not noticing those warning signs. It's quite easy to be in denial, to convince yourself something else may have happened. Was this the case with Ray, or did he have other reasons for believing there was more to this story? Unfortunately, it's almost impossible to know what Ray truly thought about his brother's death, but one thing which we can't deny is that it impacted him. He's alleged to have told a friend that he couldn't accept suicide because Roy would never orphan his children. Why then would Ray, less than 10 years later, possibly make the choice to do the same thing? Depression can sneak up on you. It can present itself in a manner you weren't expecting. We know Ray didn't like medicine and likely, if he believed he had depression, may have attempted to overcome it on his own. There are many people out there who want to fix the problem but don't want to involve medications. With Ray being so private, it's easy to imagine he might not feel comfortable talking to a therapist either, but again, this is all speculation. The one important thing to note is that when someone comes to the decision to take their own life, they're no longer thinking rationally, and so the idea of someone not abandoning their family kind of goes out the window. When looking at Ray's case, there are certain problems with the suicide theory. Firstly, if Ray planned to end his own life, how did he manage to do it in such a way as for his body to not be recovered? Usually when someone commits suicide, not only do they not try to conceal their location, but they actually want their remains to be found, perhaps not by a close relative, and so they do it someplace they know a stranger is likely to discover them. Ray has never been found, though we do have to consider the possibility that he went into the Susquehanna River and was taken by the current. However, Ray's family has stated that he was not a strong swimmer. The PA 45 bridge isn't high enough to cause death upon impact, and so, if Ray had chosen to enter the Susquehanna, he'd either have done it from that location or from the shore. Either way, he'd have been conscious while struggling to swim and slowly drowning. This does not seem like a great way to go about taking one's own life, but again, a suicidal person isn't thinking clearly. There are other options, of course. Ray could have disposed of the laptop and hard drive in that area, but gone somewhere else to take his own life. The question, though, would be how he got to the other location, having left his car behind. Someone would have had to have given him a ride. A stranger passing through town, maybe the unidentified woman. Difficult to know. But in this case, whoever drove Ray has never spoken to authorities or revealed what they may know. So really, when it comes to suicide, it's possible, but most consider it unlikely. People try to assign a reason when something terrible happens. In this case, it's strongly believed that if Ray did take his own life, he'd have a reason. Some have suggested guilt, perhaps over the horrible acts of Jerry Sandusky that he failed to prevent by prosecuting earlier. Some believe he had begun to recognize that his career was ending, and he didn't really know what he wanted to do with his life. When someone works in a career for the majority of their life, the decision to leave can bring a heavy burden. Then, of course, there's the depression. Patty says he was sleeping a lot. Some employees noted he seemed withdrawn, although many have said Ray was always sort of withdrawn at work. He was about business more so than socializing when he was on the job. Of course, depression consists of more than sleeping and not socializing. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or the DSM-5, lists 8 symptoms suggesting depression. And for a proper diagnosis, the individual must be experiencing at least 5 of them during the same period of time for 2 or more weeks. At most, with what information we have, Ray maybe had 2. Unfortunately, we just can't know what was going on inside of his head, and it's difficult to diagnose someone afterward. Depression, suicide, these are all angles which have to be taken seriously. While suicide is possible, most who examine this particular case consider it to be on the lesser likely end of the spectrum. This takes us to the second theory, that Ray's disappearance was in fact done by his own hand, but did not result in the end of his life. Many proponents of this theory believe that Ray, possessing a great knowledge of law and law enforcement procedures, would have the knowledge and possibly the ability to disappear. He would know what methods would be used to try and track him down and the best ways to avoid them. While the destruction of his laptop doesn't really make sense in terms of suicide, it definitely does if Ray was planning to disappear. We don't know what was on the hard drive, but we do know he didn't want anyone to find out. While on the one hand, many believe this suggests something criminal he may have been involved in, others consider it unlikely that Ray would have conducted illegal activities via a laptop owned by the county. We can't begin to imagine what may have been the impetus for Ray to decide to run off, but there's a good chance that the hard drive holds the key. Whether or not that hard drive can ever be repaired and examined, we've yet to see, but technology evolves every day, and who knows, someday down the road, they may have the ability to unlock the drive's secrets. Until then, we're only left with speculation. Many people believe Ray was merely planning to erase the hard drive to clear off personal data for when he returned it at the end of his term, but it seems a bit extreme to just utterly destroy it. I also find this entire situation fascinating, as one can destroy a hard drive simply by removing it from a laptop and smashing it to pieces with a hammer or drilling through it. There's really multiple methods. Pulling the hard drive and tossing both the laptop and the drive into the river seems extreme, unless the purpose was not to only to destroy the items, but to hopefully stop them from being found altogether. But then again, Ray knew how law enforcement works. He knew they'd find out about his brother, that his car was parked near a bridge in a river. He had to know they'd look into this river. He had to know they'd search it, and there's a chance they'd find either the laptop, hard drive, or both, which they ultimately did. So why dispose of it in an area right near where you're leaving your car? It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. Then again, little in this case does. On the one hand, it seems like if Ray was running off, he didn't want to be found. But on the other, it seems like he left a trail of breadcrumbs. But what if that was the whole point? He knew they'd learn about Roy. He knew they'd search the river. He knew family would say he wasn't a strong swimmer, and he knew that the river was rushing by and surging at that time. Wouldn't it be easier to escape if they already thought you were dead? That may seem far-fetched, but there are certainly those who consider this a possibility. And remember, Ray isn't just your average guy. He has a vast wealth of knowledge on how this investigation is going to work. Even law enforcement, when investigating this case, had to mull over the possibility of Ray running off and trying to make it appear as though he had committed suicide. Interestingly, based on information found in a 77-page FBI file about Ray, law enforcement learned that he had visited Eastern Europe twice in his life and that he knew people there. Police actually reached out to Interpol and requested that they distribute flyers throughout Slovenia in case Ray turned up there. Of course, there is yet to be any hits on that theory. Still, it's quite clear that investigators took the possibility of Ray running off very seriously. The question becomes, would he do so knowing the pain it would have caused his family, and did he have what he considered to be a good reason to run? I should note, in regard to Ray's FBI file, certain information has been redacted by the CIA, who are often utilized by the FBI in background checks, which is where this file originates. That being said, a lot of people believe the CIA may have something to hide, though what that could be, we simply don't know. At the same time, the CIA is notorious for redacting even unimportant information. The reason Ray may have felt the need to run is difficult to ascertain. Many believe that Ray may have been involved in something illegal and perhaps knew the hammer was going to fall soon. Is that why he found it necessary to destroy his laptop and hard drive? Of course, if you're trying to conceal evidence of a crime, it seems weird to be asking your coworkers at the DA's office how to destroy a hard drive, especially when you've already Google searched it yourself. It seems unlikely that Ray would skip town and not, at least in some form or fashion, have some level of communication with his daughter. While he loved Patty, he may have considered contacting her too risky, but most people find it remarkably difficult to accept that he wouldn't somehow get a message to Lara. As far as we know, that's never happened, and Lara has actually been the subject of a polygraph, which she passed. For a man who cared deeply about his family, felt his brother wouldn't have committed suicide and orphaned his children, it's hard to imagine he'd just disappear and essentially do the same thing. Since Ray's disappearance, there have been hundreds of sightings, though none have ever been proven legitimate. The closest one was the guy in Utah, who really does look remarkably like Ray. So it's possible he could have disappeared 14 years ago and never surfaced? Yeah, it's a possibility, but he'd had to have had a plan. Ray would need money, a place to live, a way to get there, and a way to stay hidden. How could he have pulled this off without someone else knowing the truth? Well, maybe someone does, in the shape of an unidentified woman. But still, in today's world of advanced technology, going off the grid is hardly an easy feat when you're not an internationally known missing person. Also, having Ray's fingerprints and DNA in the system, he would have to avoid ever being arrested for anything at any time. Certainly that's doable, but it's risky. Most people believe Ray, if alive, fled this country and is somewhere either where there's no extradition or where they do not have a great relationship with the United States. It should be noted, while Slovenia was considered an option, at the time of Ray's disappearance, they did not have an extradition treaty with the United States. But just 6 months later, in October of 2005, one was signed, which would have really thrown a wrench into Ray's plans, if indeed that's where he fled. So what have we got? A bright guy with a working knowledge of law enforcement procedures, knowledge of countries without extradition, insight into how to obtain items such as false identification and ways out of the country, mixed with a destroyed laptop and seriously compromised hard drive. I've often wondered if Ray's hard drive needed to be destroyed, not because it contained illegal or damaging information, but because it contained information on a possible destination. Purely speculative, but interesting to examine nonetheless. Ultimately, while it's fairly normal and easy to rule out a missing person as having gone of their own volition, this is one of the cases where the possibility is not so quickly dismissed, and many people, including investigators, consider this a likely scenario. But if it wasn't suicide, and Ray didn't choose to run away, that leaves only the possibility of foul play. In this case, there are several options attached to this final theory. Many believe Ray may have been murdered by someone he had prosecuted. Others believe it could have been someone he discovered was conducting illegal activities. Others yet consider those close to him, while some think this could all have been a random act of violence. Starting with the random act of violence theory, this one's pretty difficult to swallow. It would be remarkably coincidental if a guy, who had been looking into ways to destroy a laptop and a hard drive, took a day off from work, drove down to Lewisburg, tossed his laptop and hard drive into a river, and then on his way back to his car, was accosted by a complete stranger, without anyone in the area noticing, in broad daylight. I mention the laptop and the hard drive going into the river first, because if this was a random act of violence, it seems likely that this person would have stolen the laptop, or perhaps his phone, or even his car, or anything that might have actually earned them some cash. Certainly, a random act of violence can't be ruled out, but given the circumstances, it doesn't make a lot of sense. I suppose there's a possibility that this person could have grabbed Ray when he wasn't near his car and after the laptop destruction, perhaps in an area where no one was around, like down by the shore of the river. But again, that's a pretty specific set of circumstances. Also, what would the ultimate goal have been? Someone just out in the afternoon or early evening looking for a random person to kill? I mean, that could be the case, but it seems pretty wildly against logic. We also know from a witness that Ray parked his car in that lot at 5:30 p.m. He had driven out that way sometime between 11 and 12, which would mean he arrived in Lewisburg no later than 12:45, assuming he didn't stop anywhere. So what was he doing in Lewisburg for 5 or more hours by himself? Was he meeting someone there? Was it the dark-haired woman? Was it someone else? So many questions and so few answers. There have been many stories of people Ray sent to prison wanting revenge. That sort of comes with the territory when you're a district attorney. Imagine the hundreds of people who serve time due to Ray's prosecution. That absolutely opens the door to a huge list of potential suspects. We know one guy has come forward and said that Ray was abducted and murdered by a member of the Hell's Angels. Well, that's certainly a possibility. While this man claimed to have knowledge of the crime and Ray's location in a mineshaft, he didn't ever try to lead authorities to it. He later claimed the man he accused of the crime was dead, but then that man turned up to be alive in another state, which kinda damages your credibility. This scenario is a good blueprint, though, and kinda stands in for all of the criminal possibilities. For all of the people who could have wanted revenge on Ray, there are plenty of angles this could have taken, and it's difficult to dismiss that this could have been a case of revenge. Of course, there are questions which are difficult to discover the answers to. Did this person follow Ray to Lewisburg and then abduct him after he destroyed his laptop? How come witnesses saw Ray around town, including spending time with a woman, but no one saw him with anyone else? Ray certainly didn't appear to be threatened when he was with the woman, which seems to suggest that she wasn't likely someone he'd prosecuted or felt would have a reason to want to harm him. One theory which has been considered is that the woman was actually used to lure Ray to Lewisburg and that she played a role in setting him up for someone else. That can't be dismissed out of hand since she's never come forward, though some speculate she too may have been murdered when Ray was attacked. If it wasn't someone Ray had previously sent to prison, could it have been someone he knew and trusted? One theory argues that Ray discovered either the evidence that a cover-up had been conducted regarding Jerry Sandusky, or perhaps a completely different case, or some other form or fashion of illegal activity that was going on, and that he confronted the individual. In regard to Sandusky, Ray had been the one who ultimately had the power to prosecute or not, and he chose not to. So it would only make sense in this case if Ray himself was pressured not to, or was directly involved in the cover-up, assuming one existed. Perhaps that data existed on his laptop. Perhaps Ray was either threatened to destroy it, or made some kind of deal with someone which would result in him destroying that information. Again, this is all highly speculative, but what isn't with this case? It's certainly possible that Ray could have discovered something was going on or perhaps took part in something illegal with someone he knew and then found it necessary to destroy the evidence. It is possible that someone he trusted and was involved in a crime with could have murdered him to protect a secret. Could someone have learned something Ray had done and was therefore using that information to blackmail or threaten him? Possibly. Again, though, another scenario that could fit the bill, but for which we have no real corroborating evidence. There's a handful of questions I have, which I've never been able to locate the answers to. Whether or not law enforcement is in possession of these answers and not making them public, or themselves don't know, I can't say for sure. With the DNA evidence they have, which was pulled from the cigarette butts outside of Ray's car, does it belong to a man or a woman? One of the first things DNA can give you is the gender of the person you've recovered it from. I'd love to know why this specific detail has never been revealed and what other information it could change about this case. In terms of the woman who has never been identified, why did law enforcement wait so long to reveal this information? It seems rather pertinent. Supposedly, they didn't reveal this information because they thought they knew who the woman was and they didn't want to show their hand. Well, what made them think it was that particular woman? There must be some reason they believed Ray would be meeting this person in Lewisburg in secret. In regard to Ray's phone, what other calls were made the day he vanished, or in the days leading up to his disappearance? Were there any strange emails or text messages which might suggest a connection to someone else? Perhaps this is a dead end and that's why this information has never been discussed, but again, it's hard to say when you don't know for sure. The disappearance of Ray Grecar is one of those cases that is equally as frustrating as it is tragic. A bright man who served his community for so many years just vanishes one day after a relaxing country drive. We've got this bizarre set of circumstances, all of this information about his laptop and hard drive, witnesses seeing him with an unidentified woman, and friends and family who can't wrap their heads around the possibilities. His brother had committed suicide in an eerily similar fashion. Ray had information he wanted to conceal. He possessed knowledge of how to disappear and where he could go to stay hidden, and there's a slew of people serving time or who had previously served time who wanted revenge. Not to mention all the speculation surrounding the Sandusky case. All in all, when you add it together, you've got the plotline of a complex thriller, and yet this is reality. Ray Grecar has been missing for nearly 14 years. The story surrounding his disappearance becomes only more confusing the closer you look. All of these years later, and really, law enforcement is no closer to solving this case than they were the day Ray disappeared. In the aftermath, his daughter has had to face the difficult reality that her father is most likely not coming home. Patty, who believes she'd found her soulmate, still lives in the house they shared together, waiting to hear his footsteps on the front porch. Somewhere out there, a mysterious woman could hold the key to solving this case, or perhaps what data remains locked inside a damaged hard drive might reveal new pathways to follow. Until someone comes forward with information, a confession, or there's a break in the case, the disappearance of Ray Grecar remains open, unsolved, and very cold. If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Ray Grecar, there's a great wealth of information available online. Multiple podcasts have covered his case, and several television crime shows have covered it as well. If you have any information about the disappearance of Ray Grecar, please contact the Bellefonte Police Department at area code 814-353-2320. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. This year, CrimeCon will be held in New Orleans from June 7th through the 9th. Amidst exciting presentations and inspiring discussions, I'm really looking forward to attending and representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. If you're planning to attend but haven't yet purchased your pass, you can save 10% by using the promo code TRACE19. Simply visit crimecon.com, select a standard pass, and use the code TRACE19. That's TRACE19 to save 10% today. I look forward to seeing you there. A special shout out goes out to Patreon producers Alicia Lorraine, Krista Colvin, Deani Dyson, Eamon Brady, Kate Alexander, Megan, Chandra Moreau, and Tara Doble. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence. Visit trace-evidence.com for all episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. I want to thank you all for listening to this episode, and remind you that if you're planning to attend CrimeCon in New Orleans, to use the promo code TRACE19 for 10% off a standard badge. I'll be on Podcast Row and can't wait to meet all of you. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.